Welcome to the Composer Studio Podcast. On the Composer Studio, we listen to the music of living composers. We talk to them about their writing process, and we learn about the world of music that they live and work in.
I'm Anna Linville, and today I'm joined by guest host Shannon Estreicher. Welcome, Shannon. Thank you for helping me out with this interview.
Oh, I'm so excited to be here. I've been listening to this podcast since the beginning. And as a composer myself, I have been, of course, informed. But more importantly, I've been really inspired by your conversations, you know, especially during this last difficult year. I feel like I'm part of an artistic community, even though it's virtual. I really do feel like I'm part of it. So I want to thank you so much for the work that you've been doing. And I'm really excited to see everything that you have in store for this podcast.
Well, thank you so much, Shannon. You want to just tell us, we have a surprise guest today. Would you like to introduce our guest? Because you are old friends.
Yeah, I'm very excited to introduce our guest. Today on Composer Studio, we have a very special guest, Tarek Ghirardella, composer, percussionist, and co-founder of one of my favorite podcasts, Composer Studio. Tarek Ghirardella is an American composer of orchestral, vocal, and chamber works. His music was featured on the American Heroes Channel TV series, Gunslingers, and has been programmed by the Astoria Symphony, the Greensboro Philharmonia, and the Round Rock Symphony. As a drummer, he has toured Europe and North America and continues his work as a session drummer recording from his studio. Welcome, Tarek.
Hey, thank you so much, you guys. Be in a different seat for a change.
Yeah, we've got plans for you, Tarek. Don't worry. So, Shannon, how did you and Tarek meet?
Well, Tarek and I have known each other for many years socially, and we realized very early on that actually we're both composers. We both studied the Manhattan School of Music. And we both really love progressive rock music. And, you know, and I'm very close with Tarek and his family, and he's close with my wife. And it's just, it's been a wonderful relationship. And I have to say that I have been following Tarek's composing career since we met. And I know his pieces very well. And I'm very excited to talk about the ones that we're going to hear on this podcast. I have to say, I'm actually very inspired by his work and especially his orchestral music. He has an incredible language that he uses that I find so beautiful. And so I'm so excited to talk about it. So
how long have you two known each other?
15 years?
Yeah, 15 years. Yeah, it's been a long time. Well, you know, so Tarek, I have a question for you because I've been asking this of all my artistic friends. What have you been working on during these COVID times, and what's that been like for you?
So I'm doing something that I've never done before. I'm taking one of my favorite pieces, and I'm writing an arrangement for it. It's Knoxville, Summer of 1915 by Samuel Barber, and I'm arranging it for clarinet, piano, cello, and violin, and of course, soprano. It's weird because Samuel Barber is a very American composer. But as American composers go, that American sound that Copland made so famous and other composers as well is not as obvious in his music. And so when I got the piano reduction of Knoxville, I looked at it and I was shocked at how dissonant it was, because it doesn't sound dissonant when you hear it. Even the very, very beginning, that beautiful melody in the oboe at the beginning, it just feels so lush and so soft, but the notes are harsh. And I was really surprised by that. I think it is, Anna and I were even speaking about this the other day, there's something about Barber and the way that he's able to manipulate unique sounds and unique harmonies into something that sounds softer and prettier, you know? So that's what I'm working on now. I also do a lot of drumming, so working from my home studio. And I'm at the point where I'm trying to reinvent myself as a composer, incorporate some of the orchestral techniques that you had alluded to just a few moments ago with my drumming. And I'm trying to find some way to create something that is 100% me, that incorporates the drums, but not in a pop kind of way, with that lush, unique style of orchestration that I tend to write with.
Yeah, so Tarek, before we listen to the first piece, I just wanted to ask you how you've changed as a composer since we started doing this show. You know, what have you learned? What is the biggest thing you've learned?
So moving forward for me, because of what I've learned, speaking to so many composers from a vast range of approaches to music, is that I've learned to be much braver and courageous about being authentic with myself as a composer. You know, you hear people, and it's not just about music either, but you hear composers and artists and dancers talk about finding themselves, right? Really tapping into what they bring to the table without thinking about or without letting their inspirations from other composers get in there. You know, when I was younger, I would try to emulate other composers. I would say, all right, I'm going to write a piece like Shostakovich, like his 9th or his 10th symphony, or the Rite of Spring. You know, so many people want to rewrite the Rite of Spring. But when do you find yourself and you realize I'm no longer interested in trying to sound like anyone else? And you usually stumble upon that by accident or just by doing it more and more. Well, I've learned from all the guests that we've had and listening to them talk about how they've arrived at those places, and the music that they produce is so unique and so quintessentially them that it's made me more courageous about looking at the music that I write.
Well, let's go ahead and listen to one of your pieces. This is the trio for flute, cello, and piano by Tarek Ghirardella, performed by the Harry Patch Ensemble. Do you want to just tell us a few words about what we should expect listening to this piece?
Sure. So if anyone's familiar with the Harry Patch instrument collection, Harry Patch had microtones in his octaves. So he had a bunch of instruments that he created that had like 40 or 50 notes to an octave. And the Harry Patch Ensemble, they were the ensemble in residence at the time at SUNY Purchase. And they had asked some of the students to write a piece, but I wasn't prepared to write a piece for microtones like that. So I said, well, what traditional instruments do you have? And they said, well, we have flute, cello, and piano. Well, then that's what I'm going to write for. What I will say really quickly about this piece is that ironically, the more recent orchestral stuff that I've written, like Cenotaph, that we're going to hear in a little while, some of those techniques in the orchestration are prevalent in this piece. I wrote this piece, the trio, and then years later, I basically went back to those orchestration and rhythmic ideas.
Tarek, that was a really haunting and beautiful piece. I really enjoyed that. So as I was listening, I was thinking about two things, and I was wondering if you could speak to it. First, it seemed like in that piece, you were really playing with this tension and release, both in the way that, you know, we might kind of call it the counterpoint or harmony, or just the way the pitches were working together, but also the tension and release in the structure of the piece. So it really, like, I had a visceral reaction as I heard it. Like, it wasn't just my brain telling me that. I really felt like it was pulling and pushing, like almost like, you know, two opposing magnets kind of having this little dance. And it was really, affected me. So I was wondering if you could speak to what that is and how you worked that out also within the form.
Sure. Well, the form is ABA. I think that's pretty evident, right? It's slow and ethereal, and then it gets fast-paced and has all that rhythmic dancing going on, and then it returns to that slow ethereal section. The first part and the last part of the piece, the cello is playing harmonics the whole time, and only in the middle section of the piece is it played traditionally. And it is. It's an interplay between the flute and the cello, so that's where you hear that tension. The piece is a pitch set. It's three notes, and they're actually C sharp and D, right? So it's that small group of pitches, and then it transposes a few times during the course of the piece. But naturally, with that cluster of three notes, you're going to find tension. It's going to be inherent in there. But then there is a matter of finding out where I can find some softer moments with those three pitches too. And I think that the interplay that you're speaking of comes out because in doing it this way and giving myself parameters, I've created problems to solve for myself. How do I come to a solution? How do I find some soft tones and soft dissonances as well as the more harsh ones and make this piece a piece that feels like it's going in a particular direction rather than just random pitches, like you know, a piece of garbage. So, you know, Stravinsky used to do that a lot, where he would set himself up with scales that he would design so that he would work within parameters and as a result, problem solve and come up with these really clever solutions.
Well, what's interesting to me is, you know, the form to me wasn't very obvious. Even though it, you know, you say it's ABA, it wasn't obvious that it was ABA because the sections, they really flowed into one another. So it almost felt like you had created structure just out of tension. And that was really interesting. Hmm. And it's interesting to me that it's just three tones and that you stretched them out and it gave them, and you played with the character of those tones. It was pretty fascinating. And I was a little bit worried about you because you said this is the essence of who you are. And I don't know if I know you, Tarek, because that's very dark.
It is. Well, you know, so most of my compositions tend to have a gentle but ominous quality to them that I love tapping into that. An interesting story and kind of a funny story about this piece is that they sent out this ask for scores. It was like 2 days before it was due. And I realized, holy moly, I only have about 10 measures done. So I raced and I just sat in my room and worked it out. But man, I was really pleased with it. And it's interesting how when you're forced to do something because of the lack of time, you use the resources that you have, period. What's inside of you. You don't go around looking to find other sources of inspiration. You just get it done because it needs to get done. Deadlines are good.
Well, the next piece we're going to listen to is Cenotaph, and it's performed by the Astoria Symphony with Silas Huff conducting. This piece is one of, it's very important to you. Can you tell us a little bit about why this piece is so important to you?
Sure. It's really important to me on a number of levels. It was honorable mention with the Minnesota Symphony Orchestra reading with this piece. And so that was a bit of a milestone for me. And to get that recognition from Aaron J. Kernis and the other adjudicators was a big deal to me. But also Cenotaph, you know, I come from a military family. My father was a retired commander in the U.S. Navy, and he always spoke about cenotaphs a lot. Specifically, he was talking about the one in London. And, you know, on Armistice Day, November 11th every year, there are 2 minutes of silence that are held for all the soldiers who did not return. And by the way, that's the meaning of cenotaph. In Latin, it actually means empty tomb. It was constructed in London after World War I. My father always spoke of it with such deep emotion. And there are now more than one. There's one in Japan. They're all over the world, cenotaphs. But it can take on a lot of different meanings as well. It doesn't have to be an homage to the monuments. It could be to anyone who's fallen in sacrifice for another. You know, well, there was an empty tomb in the story of Christ as well. And so the meaning behind this message, if you will, is so broad and so big. I really try to capture a level of sacrifice that's inherent in that, thinking about the parents of lost soldiers who never returned. And man, I'm getting emotional talking about this.
Did you write this with anyone specific in mind?
That's a good question. I don't think I did. Although I will say that I did have 9/11 in mind when I wrote it. They were not soldiers, but they're certainly souls that were never brought back. There's a huge gap in people's lives for those that they've lost. You know, and that's the other thing about cenotaph is it doesn't have to be a physical place, right? The empty tomb, I mean, it could be someone's heart. Anyway, it's a really, really beautiful piece. I'm very, very proud of the piece. And I think it's for the first time I finally arrived at a voice that I felt was my own.
Well, that is the best introduction I think I've heard in a long time for anything. and I really feel your deep emotional connection to this. It feels so authentic. So talking about authenticity as an artist, you got it. So next we're going to listen to Cenotaph by composer Tarek Ghirardelli, performed by the Astoria Symphony with Silas Huff conducting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tarek. That was really beautiful. So, you know, I've as I said before, you know, I know your music pretty well, and I've noticed that you have kind of a few different I don't want to say styles, but languages that you use depending on the type of piece. And it seems, as you mentioned before, that this piece comes from a very personal and maybe even kind of a painful emotional place. And so I've noticed you have some pieces like this that are very spiritual and meditative, are the words I would use to describe them. And you have other works like Nature of Life, Tomb of Lazarus, Trisigion, and others that really have sort of a spiritual or meditative type idea, at least even in the title. And I'm curious, as a composer, when you're writing works with heavy titles like that, do you have specific techniques that you use when you're writing like that, or does each piece really have its own language? Like, how do you come to these pieces, because they're very, very profound and deep?
When I was at the Manhattan School of Music, I studied with Richard Danielpour, and he said a lot of things to me that stuck with me. One of them, though, was, I never write a piece until I'm ready to write it. So, in other words, he doesn't sit down and say, all right, I need to get this done, let me start writing it. He lets the muse speak to him first, and he knows when he's ready to start writing it. I don't have a particular approach to writing. And it's funny, listening to my music here, even though I've listened to it all week in preparation for the show, I didn't even realize some of the similarities in some of these pieces that I'm understanding now. And it's interesting to me because there are tonalities, there are combinations of notes that I've used over and over again in different pieces, totally unaware that I was reusing them again. And so there's one chord in that piece that is a very crunchy chord. It's pretty much the climax of the piece. And on the bottom is a C, and on the top is a C sharp, and all these other notes in between there. And it's this really powerful, pretty, but very dissonant chord. And I've used that in about 7 pieces, and I never was aware that I reused them the same way every time. John Corigliano, I remember reading about him actually in a book called The Muse That Sings. And he had said that he found it really interesting when he had written a piece based on the ostinato from Beethoven's 7th Symphony. He did a variations of that piece. And he kept using these certain sonorities in his music. And then later, many years later, a student of his pointed out that he reused some of those same sonorities in like 40 pieces. And he had no clue, because he was just writing. And so I don't approach it with a specific technique in mind, but yet that technique prevails, because that's what comes out of me, especially when I'm most open, when I'm channeling things the most.
One thing, you know, just from knowing you, I've learned is that, you know, you have this very complicated relationship with your family history, your father and your brother being in the military, and, you know, you being the artist, it has taken a different path. And I wonder if how that marks it, how it makes a mark on your music and your work. Do you think that has an impact, that tension between your feeling of obligation and service, and service to family, service to others, and your music?
I think so, definitely. It's something that is always on my mind, whether I'm talking about it or not. My father's career in the Navy is a big part of our family's life. You know, there's a lot wrapped up in that. And the fact that I was never in the service, it's not something that ever bothered me by any means, but I'm very proud of my family service over the years. And my father was also a history teacher and history professor. And so when he would talk about and educate us as youngsters about world history in general, I was always very prideful about the things he taught us and the opportunities he gave us. For instance, when he had to travel because of Navy duty in the summers, mostly, we would drive. If it was down in New Orleans, we would drive there, and we would spend 3 weeks getting to his destination, where he'd spend a month, and then we'd drive back. And so we visited just about every Civil War battlefield that there is and spent our time taking the tours and learning. And of course, he would educate us beyond what the guides would tell us. So that kind of upbringing, I think, in me led to pieces like Cenotaph and feeling emotional about those kinds of things.
The next piece we're going to listen to is called Late Night with Fog and Horses from the tone poem American Panoramas. So I think this is actually a really apt transition because you were just talking about all the travel you did with your family. Is this, mm-hmm. Do you think that this piece came out of that experience?
Actually, I never really thought about it that way. I knew I wanted to write a tone poem. It was a commission from the Round Rock Symphony. And Silas Huff, who conducted the Cenotaph, also was at the time the director of the Round Rock Symphony. He asked me for a new piece. And I came up with this idea of a tone poem. And I chose three American poets. And I wrote three pieces. And I wanted to cover the country, but I didn't want it to be the typical American sound, right? I didn't want to have something that was kind of cliche. I've always been a very big Raymond Carver fan since I was very young. His writing is really remarkable. He only wrote short stories and poetry, and it's very poignant in the way that Hemingway doesn't talk about setting much. He doesn't give you the background or describe where they are. You just get the conversation that they're having. And so he writes like that too, Raymond Carver, except that he's even drier. So I picked these poets less because of what they were describing or what they were talking about and more because of what they were offering artistically. So in the case of Late Night with Fog and Horses, you know, you'd think, well, what does that have to do with American panoramas? Well, he's an American poet, but what he's speaking about is so panoramic, right? I mean, it's a vision. Late Night with Fog and Horses, just the title alone, just it gives rise to this great image. You see these horses coming out of the mist. Why are they there? And then when you read the poem and you hear the background behind the couple that is the subject of the poem, it's a very dark thing, but there is some hope to this, or there's beauty in the tragedy.
Well, I'd like to go ahead and read the text just so that people can get an idea of what this is about while they're listening. Late Night with Fog and Horses. They were in the living room saying their goodbyes, loss ringing in their ears. They'd been through a lot together, but now they couldn't go another step. Besides, for him, there was someone else. Tears were falling when a horse stepped out of the fog into the front yard, then another and another. She went outside and said, "Where did you come from, you sweet horses?" and moved in amongst them, weeping, touching their flanks. The horses began to graze in the front yard. He made two calls. One call went straight to the sheriff. "Someone's horses are out." But there was that other call, too. Then he joined his wife in the front yard, where they talked and murmured to the horses together. Whatever was happening now was happening in another time. Horses cropped the grass in the yard that night. A red emergency light flashed as a sedan crept in and out of fog. Voices carried out of the fog. At the end of that long night, when they finally put their arms around each other, their embrace was full of passion and memory. Each recalled the other's youth. Now something had ended, something else rushing in to take its place. Came the moment of leave-taking itself. "Goodbye, go on," she said, and then pulling away. Much later, he remembered making a disastrous phone call, one that hung on and on, a malediction. It's boiled down to that, the rest of his life, malediction.
Thank you.
when that word malediction, it's very important. It's a very important part of this poem and part of your of this piece for you. A malediction is a curse. And it reminds me, that word reminds me of the old man who cursed the hunchback Rigoletto in Verdi's opera. Is that something that you were thinking of when you wrote this piece? What does that word mean to you?
Malediction was not in my mind when I wrote the piece. The music was less of a narrative of the poem and more of just an emotional reaction to the poem, trying to capture the mood. The juxtaposition of this unfolding separation of a couple. Feelings are crushed, way more than just disappointment. I mean, this is, you know, betrayal, hiding and concealing from one another. And then these horses, this beauty that comes out, and that juxtaposition existing at the same time. And how does a couple going through this, experiencing this, being in the same room together and having to deal with these feelings, and then suddenly have this strange thing happen out on their front lawn. How do they handle that? And how do they even get through the evening that way? There's a lot of layers, you know. I mean, we've all been in arguments with family or friends and in weird situations where we've had to share the same room or, you know, or be in the same space as them. While all this is going on in our heads, sometimes nice or sweet or hopeful things happen, and they take us out of that moment for just a brief time. But underneath it all, there's still that darkness that's always there. It never really goes away. That's the feeling that I was trying to explore in this piece.
You know, knowing you, you're very inspired by text. You're an avid reader. You write, and you, how many books do you read a year? I mean, it's not ridiculous.
Somewhere between 40 and 50.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So what is it, are you mainly responding to these external inputs, or are a lot of these feelings coming from experiences that you've had that you're trying to work out?
I think a bit of both. You know, I think like anyone who reads something, regardless of the context, they're first going to search for something in their life that they can relate to with what they've just read. But then there's also maybe I don't relate to anything in a poem or a book, but I happen to love the book.
Is it the beauty of the words that moves you? What is it about the text? What is it about text itself that seems to be so inspiring to you?
With especially with poetry, it's the beauty of the words. I can say that when I read Wolfgang von Goethe's Faust for the first time, I remember, and it's a translation of it, but I remember thinking to myself, I don't care what this is about. It is so much fun to read. The way the words flow, the sound and the consonances of these words, one next to another, the syllables, everything was just so beautiful to read. I was shocked at just the sound of it. That in and of itself brought out an emotion from me. So there's an art to that, you know, something speaking to this, something that is really special in Raymond Carver. And I don't know if you guys have ever heard Raymond Carver read his own work. He passed away in 1982, I think it was, or it might've been 88. I can't remember. If you ever heard him read his own work, flashed as a sedan crept in out of the fog, voices carried out of the fog. He draws attention to the repetition. And he also leaves the mystery of what was that phone call all about? Who was he calling? Was that the other woman, or was that something else? I mean, what was the betrayal? We don't really know. With Raymond Carver, you're dropped in after the story's begun and you're pulled out before it ends and you're left to wonder. But his beautiful prose give you a clue. That mystery paired with the beautiful sounds of his text makes for just an incredible poem, and it creates such a palette of feelings and really raw emotion as a result.
So, you know, Tarek, you know, we've known each other for a long time, and definitely one of our shared passions is for progressive rock music, and just, you know, drum-driven music. And I was really struck. I was reading your biography, and in the second paragraph it says, pulling from all styles, including classic, progressive rock, and classical. Ghirardelli writes music that embodies a rich, approachable style full of depth and intrigue. So, you know, I know that you work as well as a drummer doing session work, and you've toured throughout Europe and the United States. And I know that's a big part of your life. And I'm curious to know, like, this music, especially progressive rock music, which, you know, has, of course, a lot of complicated rhythms and melodies and complicated form, but it's so rhythm centered. And often a lot of the music can also be almost like tribal feeling, just really these driving rhythms. How does that manifest itself in your classical work? You know, because so much of your work is so tender and delicate, intimate, and lyrical. And yet you have this great, great love for drumming music. So I'm just curious to see, like, how does that work for you? Or are they just two separate universes that you can just balance?
Well, I do think it's a really good point you bring up. You know, and I had forgotten that my biography is written that way with the progressive rock in there. It's a weird thing. And we were even talking about this earlier in the week. It's almost as if my reaction to drumming and progressive rock as a composer is to completely eliminate it. It's almost as if that's my answer. That's my response, is that it's a polar opposite. It's slow. It's cathartic. It's winding instead of being marked and accented. You know, a composer like Stravinsky, you would say, well, yeah, I can totally hear a progressive rock influence in that if we're looking at progressive rock and then seeing how it may translate into something more classical. But with me, I love progressive rock. You know, I'm a huge Rush fan, always have been. And you know, Rush is retired. Of course, Neil Peart passed away last year. And no one can really fill that void for me. But the closest thing to that now is Dream Theater. And I'm a huge Dream Theater fan. And I just love the stuff that they write, even the stuff that sounds like Disney. But I absolutely love it. But when it comes to classical music, it's a strange thing because I don't want any of that in there. I've tried that. I've written pieces that have been really marked and the meter's changing every measure or every two measures. And it's been performed really, really well and it's successful. But like I was saying earlier, and I think that's kind of the theme of this whole episode for me, is that it's not me as a composer. It's just not my real voice. It's not logical. By any means, you would assume I'm a drummer my whole life. I would want to find a way to incorporate that. But at the end of the day, it's just not who I am as a composer. Now, when I spoke earlier about wanting to rediscover myself in some ways and trying to write new material that does incorporate the drums, I can guarantee you that when I finally arrive at something that feels right, it's going to be totally different from what you or I would expect.
So our next piece is called Chrysalis for String Orchestra, and this version is arranged for string quartet, and we're going to listen to a recording from a live student performance at the Manhattan School of Music. So that was Chrysalis for string orchestra, arranged for string quartet. Tarek, I noticed in the music, it was rising. The lines were just rising and rising and rising and rising. And it just had that ascension. And then it started falling and falling and falling and falling. And then it rose again. And I'm curious, the title, Chrysalis, maybe if you could tell us a little bit about what that word means and why you titled your piece that. And maybe I'll have an answer to my question about the rising and falling.
Sure. So, you know, for those who don't know, chrysalis is the cocoon stage of a caterpillar to a butterfly. I wrote this piece for string orchestra originally, but then wanted to write a string quartet. And the last movement of the string quartet is this piece. And so the string quartet itself is called The Nature of Life. And it's a three-movement quartet. The first movement is Inception. And the whole idea of that is that this is the beginning of life. For, you know, they're created and they're living out with all the energy of youth. The second movement is called Dance of the Living Spirit. And this is when, you know, someone gets a little bit older and more mature, has more wisdom about life, and they go through the different stages of life. Maybe for some that's having, you know, getting married and having for a family. For others, it could be something else. And then the last movement is Chrysalis, which is essentially death and rebirth. The way the piece is structured, there's a more dissonant section in the middle where there's a pedal in the violins, and then the cello and the violas play this very slow dance in a different key. I think it's a tritone apart from the pitch that's being held in the violin. So the first part of that is the dying before leading up to that dissonant section. It's really pretty. You got that really climactic, almost, you know, Samuel Barber adagio moment. And then it goes into this sort of avant-garde void space where all this dissonance is. And then it rises out of that at the end. It's really sweet and tender and very quiet near the end. And it repeats the material from the beginning of the piece. But now it's very quiet. That's the rebirth. I did set out with that piece to be very programmatic in that respect and tell that story. Hence the name of the piece, The Nature of Life, and the chrysalis being the end and the beginning.
Yeah, I think it's interesting that you chose a chrysalis to be the end, because normally people, I guess it is the end of one life and the beginning of another mm-hmm. life. And I think before we move to the last piece, I just wanted to ask you, I know that you don't make a living as a composer. How was that transition from, you know, the ambition of wanting to be a professional composer? What happened? What transitioned in you to make you decide that being a professional composer wasn't where your life was supposed to head at mm-hmm. that moment?
So it was partially out of my control. In 2006, my father died. And in 2005, he got really, really ill. He went in for surgery and a whole bunch of things went wrong. And that eventually led to his death. He was in ICU for 10 months out of that year. Then he was in rehab and then he returned home. And then 2 weeks later, he died. And so that was the shock that shook my life. I was married. I still was writing. I still was getting commissioned at the time, but I wasn't making a ton of money. Something happened in me when my father died that triggered the need and the desire to grow up. Because at that point, and I'm not saying that to be a composer doesn't mean to grow up, but at that point, I was still living like a college student, and I wanted to move on from that. And when my father passed away, it felt like if I don't do anything now, if I don't start taking care of things on my own, then the floor was just going to drop. So I made a decision at that point and said, I need to keep us solvent on our own and not rely on trying to get another commission, you know, or just writing another piece, not knowing if it was going to be performed or not. I continued to compose and I continued to get works performed and commissioned as well, but I needed to make a change in my life and find income and stability from somewhere else.
Do you have any regrets about, you know, about sacrificing that career for?
Yeah, that's a tough one to answer. If I sought out to get a PhD, you know, would I be looking for a position at a community college somewhere? Because they're looking for PhDs. That's their minimum standard these days. And where would that position be? You know, would I be in Alaska? There are no guarantees. You know, my daughter, I mean, gosh, she's 12 years old now. And it's just amazing to see her and why she's here and the circumstances that led up to her being here. You know, the path that my life took for us to become parents. It's just an amazing thing when you think about all the paths that you could have taken and the path that you did. You know, now I'm co-founder of the Composer Studio. That's huge, you know, and what we're able to offer and do, I think is a huge service. It allows me to stay connected to the world that I love so much, to be a part of the lives of composers and what they're doing, and then to continue my own career as a composer.
Well, it has been so wonderful to hear your music, and I'm very excited to share the last piece for this episode. The final piece we're going to hear for this podcast is a song called The Voice of God, and it's from a work called Songs from the Front Porch. The text is by Annette Nerain, performed by Walter Winterfeld on the piano, and Annette Nerain, soprano. Tarek, did you want to say anything about this piece before we listen to it?
Sure. When I was at the Manhattan School of Music, I wrote a song cycle called Songs from the Potomac. And they were Civil War letters, four letters that I had set for baritone and piano. Ned Roram was a guest professor at the Manhattan School of Music at the time. And so I had a master class with him and I showed him the songs and he wrote me a really nice letter a few weeks later. And gave me a suggestion, why don't you write a counterpart to these for soprano? Consider the mothers, the daughters, the sisters of those who are receiving these letters. And then so I met Annette. She was a soprano, but she was also an author. She was interested in writing a text for me, so I gave her the idea, and she wrote these gorgeous, gorgeous texts. You know, four songs in the song cycle altogether, and it closes with a really, really short hymn-like song called The Voice of God.
You have been listening to the music of composer Tarek Ghirardella on the Composer Studio. If you enjoyed Tarek's music, you can Google Tarek and you can find more of his music on his website. We'll also include a link to his website in our blog and in the description of the podcast. Don't forget to check out the blog on composerstudio.net, where you'll find notes, links, and playlists for our shows this season.
We want to hear from you. Have you discovered new music that moves you? Share it with us. Are you a composer who would like to be featured on the show? Contact us via our website, Instagram, or Facebook page.
And as always, thanks to our patrons for making Composer Studio possible. If you want to become a patron, just click the Become a Patron button on our website or look for us on Patreon.
Leonard Bernstein said something that seems apropos to this moment we are all living in. To achieve great things, two things are needed: a plan and not quite enough time. Have a great week. Thanks for listening.